Center.
This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
You're now in the Central Zone, where we seek to be informative, inspirational, enlightening, and dynamic. But more importantly, we seek to be fair and balanced. There comes a time when the game tolerates no spectators, only players. There comes a time when we must recognize that our individual aspirations shape our collective destiny. There comes a time when getting in the game, despite the risks, despite the challenges, regardless of the cost, is simply the right thing to do. There comes a time when we must find our hearts, find our soul, and pursue our purpose for the greater good of all, for country, for humanity. There comes a time when we must manifest our true greatness. Yes, there comes a time, and that time is now. So let's get down to the essentials. The essentials. Serious radio for serious people committed to advancing the national conversation. Evening and welcome to The Essentials, The Reset. This is your host, Hubert Edwards, and I'm very, very delighted to have you join us here on Guardian 96.9 FM. We are also streaming live on guardiantalkradio.com and also on my Facebook page, Hubert Edwards. You can find us there. This evening, we plan to have a very insightful and fundamentally sound discussion with a very, very fascinating lady, an individual that many of you know of, may not know her, but she certainly is one who commands great attention and commands great respect. And we're going to have that conversation against the backdrop of the crisis, the twin crisis that we are going through, against the backdrop of the recent Moody's downgrade, against the backdrop of a recent election result and a new administration. And so we are going to get into it tonight, and we want you to participate. If you wish, you can send us your text. Text number is 422-4796. We would like to open up maybe to some calls, but we are a little bit cautious of that. We want to ensure that if individuals do call in, they're going to be very pointed in their question, very brief, and they're also going to maintain a level of modicum, which is absolutely, absolutely necessary. So tonight, the conversation is really around this whole idea of the economy and where we are as a country and where we are going. So let's get right into it. In 2020, writing on an analysis on the Bahamas, our guest said in her conclusion, after making some points, all of the above suggests that the Bahamas is facing a potential balance of payment crisis, which is possible in the next year or two. Not because the government has not managed these crises appropriately, but because it is hard to imagine how a small, open, developing economy would be able to successfully survive its worst natural disaster in history and a global sudden stop within 1 year. A balance of payments crisis would not necessarily reflect on the authorities as much as it reflects the Bahamas' vulnerability and indeed that of many in the Caribbean. A balance of payment crisis would not, in order to create the sustainable long-term progress we desire, we must reverse our poor policy choices, such as fiscal imprudence, which have contributed to our pre-existing conditions. This pandemic, like every crisis, presents us with a precious opportunity to take a long, hard look at our current policy approach and fearlessly adopt a transformative path towards the future we deserve. And with those words, I want to welcome to The Essential, Miss Marla Dukeran, economist and leading advisor on the Caribbean. She carries the tag known for thorough analysis and database assessment and insight. Marla Dukeran, welcome to The Essentials.
Thank you so much, Hubert, and thanks so much for that warm welcome. I love your intro with Rocky's theme. Just love it. Thank you.
Yes.
Pleasure to be here.
It's a pleasure. This has been a long time coming. This is a conversation I have been looking forward to having. And so we are going to talk about the Bahamas primarily, but any discussion about any country within the Caribbean without setting a regional context is certainly not going to be useful at all. And so we must start where we must start. And I want you to kind of give us your views on what is the overall state of the Caribbean at this moment, at this point in time, and how has this crisis generally impacted our region?
Well, the first thing I would say is that, you know, the Caribbean is one big space, but there's so much variation in terms of how the economies are performing across this region. You have countries like Suriname that has just declared default last year and is going through its own balance of payments crisis and negotiating with the IMF. And you have on the other end of the spectrum, right next door to Suriname, for example, you have Guyana, that's the fastest growing economy in the world because they're the newest oil producer on the planet. And in between, you have countries that are struggling because this pandemic is, first of all, it's lasted way longer than I think most of us had expected in terms of the sheer volume and weight of the socioeconomic impact. And you have some countries that are managing pretty well. So Cayman Islands, for example, I always cite as the best run economy in the region. You know, they went into this crisis with a fiscal surplus accumulation of over $600 million Cayman dollars that the government was then able to deploy to address the fallout of the pandemic. So it's really quite a mixed basket. But I think, as I'd been recently cited in the Jamaica Gleaners, having said that, I think the Bahamas is the next most likely to succumb to a balance of payments crisis. And you set the tone and the background for that up very nicely by saying that it's not really as a result of poor policy choice. It was really the fact that the Bahamas is experiencing, you know, its two worst crises in history back to back. And in that sense, they are way more disadvantaged, if you will, than most of us in the Caribbean.
Okay.
And then beyond the Bahamas, Trinidad and Tobago, where I'm from, I think is also going to be the next, after the Bahamas, most likely to suffer from a balance of payments crisis.
Right. So, you know, that article from the Jamaica Gleaner obviously circulated very widely in the Bahamas, and it caused some eyebrows to be raised and some wagging of the tongues. But we are going to get to that. But before we get to that, you said something which I think were the way you set it. The Caribbean is really a mixed bag. And one extreme there is, let's take Suriname and maybe Trinidad, which is trending there. And, you know, a little bit Bahamas there, but we'll come to that. But on the other hand, there is Cayman. And you said Cayman is maybe the most well-run economy within the region. I think, you know, in order for us to create some bright line benchmark, let's talk a little bit about Cayman. What is it that Cayman does and does so well, which makes it draw that conclusion in your mind and which other economies, other countries can take from it?
I'm so happy that you asked that question. And it's actually not rocket science. It's two fundamental things that they got right. The first thing is, in all of our economies, the government is relatively big, okay? In most countries, the government is the largest employer. It is certainly the largest economic actor. And so what the government does or does not do has implications for everybody and everything in the country. So the way that the government behaves and its policy agenda is very, very important and fundamental to the way that the economy will perform. So fiscal policy, in my view, which is government revenue and expenditure policies, basically, to me, fiscal policy is the most important policy in all of our countries in the region, simply because the government is so large and so important. Mm-hmm. And so because the government is so important and because fiscal policy is, in my view, paramount, you have to get fiscal policy right. You cannot consistently spend more than you earn. You cannot consistently rack up debt and expect that life will continue along a happy, you know, happily ever after path. At some point, things will fall apart. And so the countries that have prudent fiscal policy are the ones that are more likely to have a better performing economy. And the Cayman Islands has a fiscal fiscal framework, basically fiscal rules that limits the size of their deficit and the amount of debt that they can incur. Because remember, the Cayman Islands is a non-sovereign. It's a British overseas territory.
Right.
Jamaica also implemented these fiscal a fiscal framework, and so did the Bahamas. And I did congratulate in one of my reports that I wrote, I did congratulate the then government of the Bahamas, the ones just recently voted out.
The FNM administration.
Right. Thank you. For implementing this this fiscal framework in the absence of an IMF program, because most countries really do it under an IMF fund-supported program. So Bahamas is an outlier already in that regard. Too little, too late, probably. But that's one of the things that Cayman gets right, that they generate a fiscal surplus every year. They put this money aside. And when there is a crisis, there is money to spend. And this is counter-cyclical fiscal policy. When things are good, we save, so that when things are bad, we have something in reserve to spend.
In a fundamental way, Ms. Dukeran, you are really encapsulating the level of resilience that the economy, an economy needs to build well before any of these external
Correct.
Shocks or vulnerabilities come into play, isn't it?
Correct. And that's fiscal resilience, I think, underpins everything else. And so having counter-cyclical fiscal policy, it sounds like a lot of jargon and it sounds complicated. It's not. Think of your own finances. When you are earning a higher level of revenue or income than normal, instead of spending it all, we should save some so that when that income level or if that income level falls, we have something that we can dip into to maintain a standard of living. Not mm-hmm. so? That's not rocket science, right?
No, that makes sense.
Exactly. So that's the first thing that Cayman gets right. The second thing that they get right is that they have an ease of doing business that, even though they've never been on the World Bank's index because they are not sovereign, they have an ease of doing business and a private sector-led growth and job creation strategy that works. In the Caribbean, we have these historical, sensitivities to private sector growth and private sector activity. There is sometimes even suspicion on the part of the government and labor, for example, of the private sector and vice versa. The thing is, the government cannot consistently generate growth and jobs. Only the private sector can, because the government really only creates jobs by taxing us. And unless we're willing to be taxed and overtaxed, then that's not a sustainable model, is it? No. So what the Cayman Islands did was they decided we're going to have fiscal prudence, and alongside that, we're going to have a thriving private sector that we're going to create an enabling environment for, and they are going to be the ones to generate economic activity and jobs for everybody, right. including half of the population of Cayman is expatriate.
Right.
So not just jobs for Caymanians, but jobs for expats as well.
For everybody within the economy, because the economy is agnostic to your nationality at the end of the day. The point you made, though, let's use Jamaica. In a furtherance of that example, given that it is closer in its status to the Bahamas. Before the COVID crisis, Jamaica had gone through a number of quarters of surplus. And while they weren't in a perfect condition coming out of those two IMF programs, they were in a better position to deploy their fiscal strategies, because there were some monies in the kitty at the point in time to be able to do so. Talk to us and kind of draw that parallel as to, you know, even though I think Jamaica is still in trouble at this moment, but, you know, how that made a difference in that the Jamaican economy could have been significantly worse than it is at this point in time.
Yeah, you know what? In the first place, what I would say is that Jamaica and the Dominican Republic are probably the two most diversified economies in this region.
Mm-hmm.
So Jamaica was not necessarily hit as hard as the very tourism-dependent economy. So Bahamas, for example, as you know, you know, 75 to 80% of tourism is cruise-based, and we know that cruises still haven't come back, right? And so what they would have been, you would have been doubly affected or more so than the average tourism-dependent economy. Whereas Jamaica has a manufacturing sector, a mining sector. In addition to tourism, they also have a robust remittance inflow from their diaspora. And so their economic structure being more diversified means that they weren't necessarily as hit as hard as the purely or almost purely tourism dependent economies. And so that's the first thing I would say.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, yes, you're right. Under the most recent IMF supported program, which started somewhere around 2012, if memory serves me correct, they implemented significant ease of doing business reforms. They had two domestic debt restructures in 2012, 2013, I think. And they engaged in a lot of reforms, in my view, that are, you know, institutional focused. So, for example, they established these two bodies that are instrumental in making sure that Jamaica stays on the right policy path and generates growth. So those two bodies, one is called the Economic Growth Council, which sets the growth policy and on a quarterly basis reports to the people as to what are the various programs we had said we would implement and where we're at with these programs and how it's going. And then there's the Economic Policy Oversight Committee, which looks at the various reforms that are needed, and it drives implementation and accountability for these reforms being implemented. And so in a sense, these are two new institutions that were born in Jamaica out of this IMF program that really drive reform and accountability for the reforms. And that, I think, really, and the Fiscal Council, which most recently, I think, was the last one that I'm aware they're going to implement. So that's three new institutions.
Yeah. And I think those are important for those who follow.
Exactly. Absolutely. They drive accountability, and that's also very important.
Yes.
A government can come to you and say in its budget speech or in its manifesto that I'm going to do all of these wonderful things. And then in a year's time, which is what happens in my country, they come and they repeat the same things. And nobody says, well, this is what I did, this is what I didn't do, and this is why. But these committees, these bodies in Jamaica are designed to drive implementation and accountability for the implementation. And I think that's what sets them apart as well.
Yeah, very, very important. And we look at, even if you follow Jamaica closely, you would have heard slogans like 5 in 5, Jamaica looking to grow to 5% per annum. Didn't happen. There was a lot of success without the critical growth which was desired, but nonetheless, they were able to move the needle forward. And one of the most fundamental needle that was moved forward, Ms. Dukeran, was the fact that they were able to, for the first time in a very, very long time, reduce the debt to GDP below 135%,
yes,
it was, and consequently freed up capacity to start investing in infrastructure. Against the backdrop of our recent Moody's downgrade, against the backdrop of historical levels of national debt, we had about just under $11 billion at this point in time. And against the backdrop of having an basically unfunded budget at this point in time for 2020, 2021, 2022, what would you say to the Bahamian public? Is there significant cause for increase on the back of Moody's downgrade?
The first thing I would say is that when I know many politicians, I don't know if this is the case in the Bahamas, but certainly in my country, many politicians demonize the IMF and the policies that they used to implement back in the 1980s, for example, which were not necessarily designed for developing countries and did do some damage. The IMF of today is very different. They had undergone significant reform, and Jamaica is, and Grenada as well, are success stories that we can look at and draw on in this region in the recent past. I would say to the Bahamian public that, yes, you face the worst two crises ever in your history, but a balance of payments crisis is not the end of the world. I'm in Barbados right now. Barbados had a balance of payments crisis in 2018 and went to the IMF. And you know, whilst Barbados is struggling and is experiencing economic decline because of the pandemic, the reforms that are on the agenda to be implemented and the support, financial and otherwise, financial and technical, that Barbados is getting from the IMF, the IDB, the World Bank, the CDB, and so on, the multilateral lending agencies, that kind of support basically means more likely to get it right and to implement the right policies and to set your economy on a sustainable socioeconomic trajectory. And I want to emphasize the social part, because I know people get scared when they hear there's going to be an IMF program and they think, oh my God, half of the public sector is going to be laid off and our social programs will be canceled and, you know, poverty will rise. As a matter of fact, in Jamaica, when the IMF negotiated their program, they actually set a minimum of how much the government should spend every year on social welfare programs. In other words, you cannot spend any less than this. You have to spend at least this, and you could even spend more on social programs. Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. So I just want to dispel that misconception that there is necessarily negative social implications as a result of an IMF program. That is not necessarily the case. The second thing I want to draw your attention to is the fact that in 2019, Jamaica experienced and recorded its lowest poverty level ever, and just when they were exiting the IMF program. So it means that the reform agenda from 2012 to 2019, in conjunction with the IMF, actually helped them to alleviate poverty and reduce poverty. So that's the first thing I would want to say. It is not the end of the world. It is not doom and gloom. It is likely that your country will be put on a more sustainable and healthy and progressive path with an IMF program than without.
Yeah, but
you just have to look at the example of Belize that did their debt restructure without an IMF program, and guess what? They're a serial defaulter like Argentina now.
Mm-hmm. But let me ask you, Ms. Dukeran, because often we think in extreme, or we react in extreme. So we treat the IMF as a boogeyman, or we think mm-hmm. it's great on one side, depending on your perspective. But this idea that there will be this huge positive going forward, isn't there a price to be paid someplace in the middle? Because there's absolutely no free lunch. Jamaica, for example, as successful as that those programs have been defined or described, they happen on the back of negligible growth. And so someplace in between, the taxpayers must have at least sacrificed significantly to achieve that. Talk to us about, you know, what sort of disruption could there be to, you know, general standard of living, if you will.
So Hubert, I think that's an important point you make. There will be negative implications, because any reform agenda, any transformation, any socioeconomic transformation is likely to have like anything in life, there are positive as well as there are negative implications. So yes, there could be pain, and they, under an, any kind of public sector retrenchment program, for example, there is a possibility that there could be pain. It depends on how it's managed. For example, in Grenada, under their program, they never had any public sector retrenchment. Okay, so it depends on how, what is negotiated and how it's implemented. But yes, you're right. There is, under these reforms, you can have some disruption. So some of the kinds of disruptions that could come with an IMF program is, for example, in the case of Jamaica, they reform their foreign exchange regime to allow for movement of the Jamaican dollar both ways, and they did other reforms to the exchange rate regime that meant that the Jamaican dollar was, you know, it did actually lose value over a period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Now it moves both ways, but it did actually lose value for a period of time. So that's a possibility. Okay. It depends whether or not you decide to touch your exchange rate. Barbados decided not to. Okay. So it doesn't mean you necessarily do. Another one that, you would, you know, generally see under an IMF program, you will see a lot more efficiency being, you know, sought after in the public sector. So digitization, more government services going online, basically e-government. And Bahamas is well placed to capitalize on this because they have a you have a digital currency, which allows the public sector and the private sector to perform transactions much more efficiently in terms of time and cost. And with efficiency, you can have growth, right? And increased productivity. It doesn't necessarily mean people go home. It could mean that people go to other jobs that, the economy creates. So I think that, yes, there is a chance there will be pain, but I think it is also, you know, important to remember that it's not going to all be negative, but it's not going to all be positive.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that the IMF has learned a lot having gone the programs in the Caribbean in the past decade. So they know, they have a better sense of what works and what does not work. I would not be fearful is what I would like to emphasize.
Okay. Your message, therefore, don't be fearful. But however, in June 2021, in your analysis of the budget at the time, you said... Mm-hmm. The Bahamas is in the midst of its worst crisis in history. The data unfortunately suggests that the current situation is still unsustainable from a fiscal and external standpoint. As such, an orderly debt reprofiling exercise is preferable versus a disorderly debt restructure balance of payment crisis. The issue which is driving all of this discussion at this point in time is where the Bahamas is with its national debt. We have climbed to 10.5, 11 billion, depending on how you count it, whether you put in contingent liabilities or not at any point in time. How do Bahamas look forward to tomorrow without the possibility of entering into an IMF program?
Well, I mean, it's possible to do it. Like I said, you know, Belize has done it. They've attempted to do their debt restructure without an IMF fund-supported program. Suriname did at one point, up until very recently, they tried to restructure, but to implement.
But both of them have been largely unsuccessful.
Exactly. Because in the first place, if you couldn't implement reforms in the past to set your country on the right path, why would you be able to do it now? What makes the difference? You have the same politicians, the same public sector. What makes the difference?
What if I say to you, Ms. Dukaran, as I know many persons will say, we just had an election and we now have new politicians, new party running it. What would be your response?
But haven't we had this party before?
New personnel.
Okay. Fair point. And, you know, who knows? Let's give them a chance, right? Maybe they will be able to get it right. But the other thing is that when you've had downgrades the way Bahamas has had and you're no longer investment grade, there's a lot to be said for credibility and basically investors having faith in you. Because when the government, as you said, they have an unfunded budget that they need to raise money for, when they go to the market to try to raise this money, to try to borrow, an investor that knows that there is an IMF program behind it, where there is technical assistance, financial assistance, a reform agenda that means this will not happen again, I believe investors are much more likely to take on government paper and lend money to the government versus the absence of an IMF program where they are not quite sure that the government get it right. And if the government does not get it right, the government of the day does not get it right in terms of a reform agenda, it means that at some point you will actually default and you will have to go to the IMF. Whether you do it, you know, as a proactive strategy and you do an orderly restructure and you implement reforms, or you wait until you have not a cent left, that there's a big difference between what that looks like, those two options, right? Okay? And we don't want to wait until there's absolutely nothing left.
Okay.
So I would say to you that there is a lot more credibility and transparency as well when there is a fund-supported program versus when they go it alone. And that's just been the evidence from around the region.
Okay. And so we are having this conversation with Marla Dukran, Caribbean economist and advisor. And we are hearing about the pros and the cons, the ins and outs. We are putting things in context within the region. We are at least proffering examples from Suriname all the way up to Guyana, which I think now is growing at about, expected to grow at about 40% per year. And before that, it was as much as 80%, I think. So
yes,
we are going to run the full gamut. We are hearing that Cayman, and this I know will cause us to stand up and think, because we often make the comparison of the Bahamas with the Cayman, given the similarity, especially in the financial services industry. And so we are, you know, we want to get into the ins and outs. We want to, at the end of the day, when we finish this, ladies and gentlemen, we want to have a better understanding of where we stand and the options available to the government, to this new administration, especially. So you're listening to The Essentials, The Reset. We're going to take a break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about debt and the impact and debt to GDP and benchmark 30%, 60%, 100%. What does those things mean for the capacity and the ability for a country to grow? Don't move. Come right back.
Now that your age is not everything, now that your kids call you for advice, now that you can achieve anything you set your mind to, why stop? Nourish your strength and energy with Ensure. Ensure provides protein, antioxidants, key vitamins and minerals to support your immune system. Now that it's your moment to enjoy your vitality, why stop? Your life, your health, your Ensure.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and all from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your App Store for your Apple device or Play Store for your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
For the best jerk in the Bahamas, you must have Balu's. Pork, fish, and chicken served with our delicious country-style sauce and authentic festivals. Balu's, Nassau East South. Call or WhatsApp 376-8951. Balu's, the jerk with the soul of reggae and the spirit of Junkanoo. Balu's jerk, traditional, slow-cooked to perfection. 376-8951. Get yours today.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
And welcome back to The Essentials. We're having an insightful conversation so far, chock full of information with Marla Dukeran, economist and advisor, leading advisor in the Caribbean. Again, if you want to ask questions, if you want to get in some, then certainly use our text line. I will read those questions out to Ms. Dukeran at the appropriate time and we get responses, 422-4796. So, Ms. Dukeran, we have a national debt of $10.5 billion. And as at the current budget, before the downgrade by Moody's, we had budgeted $512 million for interest payment, which represent the highest level of debt service in the history of the country, representing some 18% of budgeted expenditure. I want you to kind of unwrap all of that in context of benchmark. We usually say debt to GDP should remain someplace below 60%. Talk to us about how that is important, why that is important, and how we should be viewing the increasing need for debt financing and what that has on the productive capacity of the country.
We talk about that. I just want to give a little bit of an explanation as to why, because I guess a lot of people don't understand why this is important. And there are those who believe that, you know, you should just borrow and then, you know, get forgiveness and continue to borrow. The thing about it is there are only two major ways in which a country like ours in the region, small open economies, there are only two things that really drive growth: investment and exports. Everything else, government spending, private consumption, imports, all of net drain on our economy because it is heavily import dependent, right? Investments and exports is how we grow. When the government spends and overspends consistently over a period of time, it means that they are leaving less money to invest, to spend on healthcare, education, infrastructure, and all of those things, as you rightly say, increase the productive capacity of our country because they have to spend more and more money servicing the debt that they've incurred because they've overspent. So that is why debt is a problem. It affects growth, it affects the long-term viability of your economy, and it even is shown to have implications as well for human development because it affects how much the government spends on education, how much they spend on healthcare, et cetera, et cetera. So this is why we have to focus on this issue. Now, there is a curve, there is a positive relationship between borrowing and growth. Mm-hmm. When debt is sort of below 30% of GDP in general, there is a positive relationship between when the government borrows and the growth of the economy. Because presumably the government borrows and uses this money to invest in infrastructure and other investments. However, that positive impact diminishes over time until you get to about 55 or 56% debt to GDP on average. And then that relationship between debt, each additional dollar of debt and growth becomes negative. So each additional dollar of debt, once you've crossed 55 or 56% debt to GDP, each additional dollar of debt actually causes your economy to shrink.
So basically, okay, before you go, I just want to make sure that persons hear that. So from 1% up to 30%,
Somewhere around
30%, generally speaking, there is going to be a deflation. The more money you borrow money, you're likely adding to the expansion of the country. The expansion.
It depends on what
GDP.
You spend the money on, but in general, yes.
Assuming that you're spending it on the right things.
Exactly.
Once you cross that 30% threshold up to 56%, it still grows, but it grows at a diminishing rate.
Correct.
And then once you hit the 56 or so, and that is why we usually use that 60% benchmark or rule of thumb, it now then changes to a negative relationship.
Yes.
Which therefore puts the Bahamas firmly in that position.
Absolutely. There are maybe just two or three economies in this region that are not in that region. Of course, Cayman being one of them. So most of us are in negative territory. We're on the dark side of debt, basically. We need to get back to the light. So that's one way of looking at the sustainability level of your debt. The other way of determining whether it's sustainable or not is looking at the primary fiscal balance. If you have a primary fiscal deficit, you know the overall deficit is what the government talks about in the budget, right? And they say we have revenue of $5, we have expenditure of $7, so our deficit is $2, okay? Right. Yes?
Yes, I'm with you.
Right. A primary deficit, however, is when we are already in deficit before we pay the interest on our existing debt.
On our debt. So let me break this down for the layman. Mm-hmm. So you are working $100 per week,
mm-hmm.
right? And you make up a budget. Of course, you owe the bank $5,000. And before you make allowance for the interest you're supposed to pay on that $5,000, you already run out of money.
Exactly.
You are in a deficit. So you are displaying a primary deficit.
A primary deficit. And when you know that you are in unsustainable debt territory, regardless of what your debt to GDP is.
Mm-hmm.
It means your debt is already unsustainable because you are borrowing to pay interest on loans that you already took.
Right. And the Bahamas in its 2021-22 budget, I think, had a primary deficit of somewhere around $30+ million. I can't remember the exact figure, but there is a primary deficit in this current budget.
Yeah, I am seeing here in my data for 2020 to 2021, mm-hmm. $930 million. Is the primary deficit, and 2021 to 2022 fiscal year, 439 is what
okay.
is projected.
I stand corrected. So that definitely puts us in a place of bother. Every single thing that we borrow from here on in, we will have to borrow to pay the interest and also borrow to deal with any level of refinancing or rescheduling.
Correct. Exactly.
Now, Ms. Dukeran, we have a new administration, and you know there's always the possibility, as we have explored earlier, that with a new administration, and if especially their significantly new personnel, you could have a new way of thinking, and you could have a different outlook. But as election goes, the party usually makes certain promises. In this mm-hmm. instance, the Bahamas is now under the leadership of the Progressive Liberal Party. They have formed the government. And in their blueprint for change, one of the things that they promised as part of their campaign platform was a reduction of 2% in VAT, effectively reducing revenue. How do you see this in light of the stock of debt that we have, a primary deficit, and the most recent downgrade from Moody's? Is this a wise move?
Well, I think what motivated that type of an announcement, apart from the political motivation, might be that they know that Bahamians are suffering, okay, because of this twin crisis that you're facing, and perhaps they see it as a way of putting money back into the hands of the average Bahamian. The thing about it is that kind of policy in and of itself, you know, all other things remaining the same, will cause a reduction in revenue. However, unless they announced some revenue measure or measures, for example, I know that a corporation tax has been discussed, and we know even globally there is a discussion underway a bit about implementing minimum corporate income tax.
Yes,
perhaps that's the trade-off that they had calculated. I am not sure.
You brought up a very important point and a very sensitive point for the Bahamas. I think right after the IMF, corporation tax or income tax is the next boogeyman. The next scariest thing for the Bahamas. So the moment you mention corporation tax or income tax, there is going to be a significant blowback. But the larger point you're making is if the tax treatment is revenue negative, then as a policy position, it's going to be challenging.
Absolutely, because it then makes the deficit bigger and it means that the government has to borrow more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's from a policy perspective, unless there are mitigants, and maybe the corporation tax is one of them, I'm not sure, it does not sound like a wise move. The other thing is that, and I want to highlight this, that the VAT in the Bahamas is actually the most efficient VAT in the region. Okay. In terms of the way that it's administered. And so, you know, it's well designed, it's administered well, and it's efficient. And so I would look to that tax to actually help me to raise revenue and not the opposite. So I just on the surface, I don't know that I agree with this policy of reducing the VAT, mm-hmm. unless there is some mitigant that I'm not aware of. On the flip side, you know, the government also needs to be cognizant of the size of this deficit and the rollover risk. So, you know, there's one thing to go out there and borrow new money, and they've been borrowing money a lot from the multinationals. So the World Bank, I think 100 million, the IDB, and so on. And this is to borrow because you usually get cheaper rates than if you have to borrow commercially by issuing a bond on the market. And you usually have better repayment terms, okay? But there is also rollover risk in the sense that there is existing government paper out there, right? Bonds and T-bills and so on, that when they mature, tend to be rolled over, meaning you don't pay off those who hold the bonds. You tend to just roll it into a new instrument. Mm-hmm. With the downgrade and with the understanding of the crisis that is enveloping here, I think that there is a greater chance that, which is what happened in Barbados, that you will have more and more investors saying, I do not want to roll over. I actually want my money back. And so in addition to having to borrow and finance this existing deficit that we all can see in the budget, there is this, and you talked about it, this rollover risk, this risk that the debt that is already on the books, when it matures, some investors may say, I actually want my money back because I think the risk of holding this is just too much for me.
Okay, so within that context, when we look at the current budget, the borrowing requirement for the fiscal year 2021-22 is $1.8 billion. That $1.8 billion can be deconstructed into the $951 million, which is needed for the current deficit, and the rest of it is for interest payments and debt repayment. So approximately 1.4 of that will go towards some sort of a debt repayment or interest payment specifically. What sort of challenges you think the government is faced with? Of that 1.8, I think we have only secured $200 million so far.
Yeah, so rollover risk is one of the challenges, but also especially given the downgrade, it means that when they borrow from the market commercial debt, they will likely have to pay higher interest rates because the risk associated with holding Government of Bahamas paper has gone up. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so that means that it's just more and more expensive each time you come to the market to borrow given the circumstances. And then it's a vicious cycle the more you borrow, the more interest you have to pay, the wider your fiscal deficit, the wider your primary deficit, and then you get downgraded again because your debt is now bigger and you're still not growing. And then when you get downgraded again, it starts all over again. More expensive debt, et cetera, et cetera. And so it's a spiral. And so that's something the government has to be aware of. There are other ways of raising money. Governments can divest state assets, but again, that is not a sustainable, it's not a solution to an economy that is suffering from the effects of policy choices that were not the best over time. It might help to finance this year's deficit. If you sell off a state asset, it might help to finance this year's deficit, but it really does not solve the fundamental problem that created the deficit in the first place. Mm-hmm. Okay? So there are ways that they can, and of course they can implement taxes to raise revenue.
Right, and there's always that possibility. In some instances, the scariest possibility.
Well, I guess to some it's scary. I mean, I've spent my whole life in a country where we had income tax and corporation tax and VAT. So, you know, and we still get by. So, I mean, it's not the end of the world. But I understand from a cultural and historical perspective, it's not what you're used to.
Right. Now, I want to ask you, because the kind of spiraling, sitting in that type of a vortex, where you get to this point of critical mass that every decision gets squeezed through this vortex of a very heavy debt burden, and you now have to start making choices. But, you know, as someone watching via Facebook just indicated, that the problems of the Bahamas started with Dorian. If I was to say that to you, Ms. Dukeran, would you agree, would you disagree?
I do not agree.
Why?
Bahamas was downgraded to non-investment grade before Hurricane Dorian hit. So there were challenges. I mean, when I first started really looking at the Bahamas economy, it was in 2011, when I had joined RBC as their economist for the Caribbean. And it was clear to me back then in 2011 that there were problems. Not unlike many countries in the Caribbean. I'm not singling you out, okay? But it was clear to me that there were problems. And in the downgrade, I think, was it in 2015 or 16, where S&P downgraded down to non-investment grade. And so, you know, it to say that the problem began with Dorian is not a fair statement. Okay, so there was fiscal imprudence that led us to a heavily indebted situation, primary fiscal deficits, and an unsustainable debt level that led us to non-investment grade or junk, as people say. And then you had Dorian, and then you had the pandemic. Mm-hmm. So these two crises made things impossible from my perspective.
Yes.
But they are not the cause of the problem.
Isn't it just more than a little bit, well, let me put it this way. Isn't it important for us to actually fess up to the position that there were and still remain significant structural weaknesses in the economic arrangement of the Bahamas in
Absolutely.
Order for us to go about making the fundamental fix, which is going to secure the resilience that we need, even as we try to grapple with this particular crisis?
Absolutely. The only way you can fix your problems is by, first of all, identifying what they are. I think that an overdependence on tourism is a challenge for not just the Bahamas, but for many other countries in the Caribbean. In your case, in the Bahamas, it's particularly difficult at this time because of how heavily dependent you are on cruise tourism, particularly the East Coast U.S., which, I mean, cruise tourism, I think, is not going to come back for a while, and certainly not the way it used to be, because we know now that cruises were a vector to spread this virus, and so we know they were cutting corners as it relates to sanitation and so on. So I think that that's one of the problems, this overdependence on tourism. The other thing is, this is a problem in most Caribbean countries. As we discussed earlier, you need to put something aside so that when things turn south, we have something to rely on. And I'll give you an example. In Trinidad and Tobago, we have the region's only well-established sovereign wealth fund. We call it the Heritage and Stabilization Fund. Mm-hmm. Right now, it's got about $6 billion US in it. Successive governments in my country have only ever deposited $2.6 billion US into this fund. And a fund, but the fund manager over the years has been able to earn multiples times that, like probably about $7 or $8 billion over the years, based on the 2.6 that was invested. Mm-hmm. And so the government is able to draw down on this fund to finance a proportion of its fiscal deficit every year, based on the legislative amendment that they passed. So my point to you is that don't think that your 100 million that I can save, that 100 million can grow into a billion, you know, and become something substantial. I think it's important for every country to have some sort of a fiscal buffer that they contribute to every year that's there growing and can be accessed when fiscal revenues collapse.
And that is certainly, I think, an important aspect, both of the major political parties, and I think all parties that were running, but certainly the one that won, have committed to the establishment of a sovereign wealth fund. There is legislation in the Bahamas that speaks to that, but that needs some level of overhauling. And as a result of that, you know, I think it's a step in the right direction. In the case of Trinidad that has natural gas deposits and stuff, what constitute the asset that is in the currently in the in your national sovereign wealth fund?
The fund manager chooses various instruments to invest in. They're usually bonds, but some I do not know the current composition. But depending on what your investment objective is, they put it in instruments that will be relevant and appropriate based on your objective.
Okay,
not local government paper. They invest in U.S. treasuries, yes, and other global investments.
Definitely. Now, Mr. Curran, you mentioned at the beginning, you touched on something at the beginning when you were referring to Jamaica, and that is the floatability or additional flexibility of its currency as it went through those IMF program. As you well recognize, like Barbados, the Bahamas have a fixed peg, and that peg is significantly reliant or dependent on reserves. The Bahamas is experiencing maybe a little bit of a phenomena, and you would have alluded to this in your 2 December 2020 paper. Ever-increasing incursion in this idea of borrowed reserve, usable and non-usable reserve. Can you help us to understand these terms so such that the public has a better appreciation of the dynamics at work when we talk about external reserves, the reserves of the Bahamas, and how that may impact ultimately the peg arrangement in place?
Okay, so the reserves of foreign currency held by the central bank are basically the reserves, the sum of money that is used to defend this exchange rate, this one-to-one between the Bahamian dollar and the US dollar. Okay, meaning that if everybody came to the banks and tried to buy US dollars, these US dollars have to come from somewhere. And the central bank holds a stock of reserves that they can defend the currency with. In other words, sell to the market if they need demand for US dollars relative to Bahamian dollars. If a central bank finds itself in a position where they do not have sufficient reserves to defend their currency, they end up not selling, which has happened in my country. Not that they didn't have enough, but by policy choice, they do not inject enough into the market to satisfy the demand for foreign currency. And what that leads to is, in the case of my country, you end up with a black market for foreign currency. Okay, so the value of the Trinidad and Tobago dollar officially is $6.8 to one US dollar, but on the black market, it's anywhere around $7.50, $8 Trinidad dollars to one US dollar. So this is why it's important for the central bank to hold the stockpile of foreign currency to defend the exchange rate with its local currency. And in general, the level of reserves you want to hold, there are two measures that we look at. In the first place, there's a precautionary benchmark of you want to hold at least 3 months of worth of import cover in your reserves. Meaning, let's say your import bill is 100 million a month, you want to hold at least 300 million of foreign reserves in the central bank, so that should something happen and there is a crisis, you have 3 months of buffer that you can sell to the market so that they can pay for their imports of food and medicine and whatever else that we need to import. The other benchmark we look at with respect to how much reserves do we need to have, if your exchange rate is 1-to-1 and you have, let's say, 100 million Bahamian dollars in circulation, in terms of your money supply, you want to have 100 million US dollars sitting in the central bank to back this Bahamian dollar, these Bahamian dollars you have in circulation in the local money supply. So that's the other benchmark we look at. There are instances where you have countries that continue to print and print. This happened in Barbados in the run-up to 2018 default, where the central bank pretty much doubled the money supply in a time frame of about 4 years leading up to 2018. And that ratio between the stock of reserves and the money supply, the domestic money supply, instead of being 2-to-1, which is the exchange rate here in Barbados, it got to something like 12-to-1 at one point in time, if not more. So that's the other thing we look at. We try to make sure that we have reserves to match the exchange rate and the level of the money supply domestically.
Right.
So the thing about borrowing, which is what the Bahamian government before was doing to increase the level of reserves, when you borrow in US dollars, you have to repay more and in US dollars. Okay, so when you borrow 5 US, you don't pay back 5. You pay back, let's just say, 7. So it means that your country has to earn foreign exchange. The more foreign debt you accumulate, you have to earn more and more foreign exchange to service this debt. So it places an additional burden on you. It's a burden to repay, but it's also a burden to repay in that currency. Okay? It doesn't matter how much you earn as revenue in Bahamian dollars and VAT and so on. You have to earn this money in hard currency, in US dollars. So borrowing to prop up your reserves is not a sustainable solution. Your country should be able to earn enough foreign currency from its exports and in its investments and so on to finance its import bill. And one of the ways in which we experience a net outflow of this foreign currency, as we had experienced in Bahamas, you know, in the last, and most countries in the region, is the fact that the government spends more than they earn. And by spending more than they earn, what they're doing is they're driving higher imports, because we import 80% or so of what we consume, no?
Mm-hmm.
So the more the government spends and the more they overspend, the more they drive the outflow, the net outflow of foreign currency and the reduction in the level of reserves.
Yeah, so, you know, it's something really for us to pay attention to. We are going to take ourselves a break here. I see there's a caller. Let's call before I go to the break. Caller, welcome to The Essentials. Go ahead, caller, you're on The Essentials.
A godly day to this dark in the waste along with you and your guest.
Go ahead, you have a question?
Yes, I have a question.
Go ahead.
My question is, in order for the main bank, the city, the central bank, to go to avoid them to going into the black market, can they just buy some American currency? And if it's possible, wouldn't it be cheaper than borrowing? And what percentage we would have to spend on a dollar if we were to buy the American currency?
When you say buy the American currency, you mean to dollarize the economy?
Right, yes.
Okay, thank you. Did you hear that, Ms. Dukaran?
Yes, if what he means is, why don't we just adopt the U.S. dollar as our official currency? Is that his question, to dollarize?
Yeah, pretty much.
So there are two things you have to do to dollarize. An intensive IMF program, because it means this is a huge transformation, right? And it takes years to effect this kind of change. So that's your first thing. Immediately, you need to go to the IMF for help to do this. The second thing is you need to apply to the Fed for permission. And the Fed may or may not agree to give you permission. And if they do, you have to pay them because you are basically compensating them for the currency that they're giving to you, for the use of that currency.
Right.
Okay. And the third thing is, when you are dollarized, you are basically sacrificing all of your monetary policy. You're volunteering to wipe monetary policy pretty much off of your policy toolkit, because all your monetary policy is then going to be set by the Fed. So, for example, when the Fed decides to increase interest rates, as they've just signaled they will do, it means interest rates in your country are going to go up because you don't have control over interest rates on U.S. dollars. That's in the control of the Fed.
Yeah.
So it sounds nice and it sounds easy, but it's not.
Yeah.
And you do have some countries that have done this. In the Caribbean, back in 2010, when some of the Dutch jurisdictions got status aparte from the Kingdom of the Netherlands, so when Curaçao and St. Martin decided that they wanted status aparte, Bonaire, Saba, and St. Eustatius decided that they didn't want to do that. They wanted to dollarize. And so they converted to using the U.S. dollar as their official currency.
Yeah.
And so I think that's the most recent example in this region.
Okay, thank you. As an extension, there's a quick question I want to ask you. It therefore means that as long as the economy isn't dollarized, the local authorities have control over its own monetary policy, as would be the case with the Bahamas.
The Bahamas does have control over its monetary policy. The other instance in this region where you do not have control directly over is when you're part of a currency union. So, for example, the Eastern Caribbean Currency Union that uses the EC dollar.
Yes.
And then you have the monetary union between Curaçao and St. Martin. They use the same currency.
Great.
And so you know, each individual country alone cannot set monetary policy. They have to come together to agree.
We have another
it's
caller.
It's like the EU, yeah.
Yeah, we have another caller on the line. Caller, you have a quick question. You have a question. Go ahead.
Yes, good night, Mr. Hubert Edwards, Berenice Johnson, the original. And your guest is a Barbadian, you say?
She is from Trinidad.
I'm from Trinidad.
And she lives
Trinidad. Good night to you, dear.
Yeah.
My question on, not question, but
no,
my
comment. We're only doing questions. You have a question, ask your question.
Okay, well, my question will be, how is it that the British territory of Turks and Caicos Island, that is not who has severed ties with the Bahamas, is enjoying the privileges of the United States of America currency, where we, as the American protectorate, the Bahamas is protectorate, is not doing so? We have the solution for that, but how?
Okay. Thank you for your question. I'm not sure you got that right. The Bahamas is not a protectorate of the United States, but go ahead, Ms. Dukaran, if you can.
I think you answered it right there.
You know, it's not a protectorate, but why?
No.
Go.
Why would you have your own currency? You know, because it gives you policy tools with which you can manage your economy. You can manage your money supply, you can manage your interest rates, et cetera. And that gives you ways that you can move the needle in your economy as you need to. If you, again, if you adopt somebody else's currency, then you're basically adopting their monetary policy, as the case is.
Thank you. Thank you so much. For very, very selfish reasons. Very, very selfish reasons.
I actually have to run.
Yes.
So could that be the last call that we take, and maybe we just wrap up?
Yeah, of course. But what we want to do is to kind of just shift it to a few outlook, positive outlook. So as we wrap up over the next 5 minutes or so, Ms. Dukran, what are some of the reforms you expect to see? I see the PLP, the new administration, indicating that they're going to look at economic reform, stabilizing public finance, fiscal responsibility, debt management, reform Invest Bahamas, that's the investment authority, look at the ease of doing business, and maybe pursue a new tourism model. As we look to the future, where should we be concentrating?
I think in the short term, there needs to be some reprofiling of the sovereign debt,
mm-hmm.
because it's, as we discussed.
And by reprofiling, you mean?
Meaning that restructuring the debt where it is, you get either some debt relief in terms of principal being written down, and or securities and lower interest rates by negotiating with the holders of these instruments.
Okay.
So that it makes the debt more affordable and more sustainable going forward. That's the first thing I would focus on in the short term.
Right.
The second thing is, and already there is a legislation around fiscal responsibility, and that's something that I would look to implement and adhere to, so that we don't end up in the same problem in the next coming few years. As part of that, building that buffer that we spoke about, whether in the form of a sovereign wealth fund or just saving, putting aside this money. The other thing, yes, they talk about the ease of doing business, and I think that's very important. Those are important reforms. I think that, Bahamas and Barbados being the only countries in the region that have foreign exchange controls, I actually think that foreign exchange controls are a major deterrent and disincentive to foreign investment. And I would really look at this policy. And I know that the authorities, the previous government, had rolled back some of these restrictions and made and liberalized a little bit, where people, for example, you can hold domestic accounts in US dollars. Those kinds of reforms to liberalize the foreign exchange market, I think, will serve Bahamas well in the longer term, once you have these fiscal and ease of doing business reforms intact. And so those are the things that I would focus on.
So, I think, we have to, unfortunately, you have to leave us with a couple of minutes to go, but I think you gave us a significant work through as to what the issues are and where we stand. So basically, when we heard the where you were cited in the Gleaner, it's not all doom and gloom. While you're saying that the Bahamas is potentially faced with some challenges, there are obviously some things that can be done, should be done, must be done if we want to avoid having that dance with the IMF. And so finally, as we close, Ms. Dukran, in 2019, the Oxford Economics did a review which was commissioned by the Chamber of Commerce as it relates to the Bahamas ascending to WTO. And one of the things that they conclude was this, I read it. What is also clear from our study is that WTO ascension alone will not be a panacea for the current problems facing the Bahamian economy. In order to achieve a sustainable acceleration of growth, policymakers need to embark on a more ambitious and broad-based reform agenda to improve the domestic business environment. Would you concur with that sentiment as your final statement out?
Absolutely. I would agree with that. Improving the local business and private sector environment is critical. Labor force reforms, customs reforms, and those kinds of things are very important to generate growth and jobs. The other thing is we have a spectacular new head of the WTO. So that's a goal that I think is worthy of pursuing right now, but more now than ever before.
Yes, well, you know, that is something which will have to be taken up by this particular administration. Mr. Curran, we want to thank you so much for your time. We want to thank you for your expertise. We want to thank you, Graham, and really helping us to better understand, one, where you stand, the context that we are operating in from a Caribbean perspective, and some of the specific issues which are impacting the Bahamas. And I guess persons should walk away with the idea that, yes, we are in a place where we are in a spot of bother, but it's not total doom and gloom. If we were able to walk back and to correct some of the ills or some of the decision, the policy choices that we have made in the past, the future could be bright. Thank you so much. We will continue this conversation at another time, and we are so much indebted for the time you were able to give us today.
Thank you, Hubert. I really appreciate being on the program today, and I wish all of the Bahamas the best with this new government, and I hope that they don't disappoint any of us. Thank you.
Definitely. You have a good day. Rest of evening, rest of night, and we will talk at a later point. We'll take a break here, and when we come back, we will wrap this up in summary. We still have a few minutes. We could get in one or two calls, but you'll have to only talk to me. You're listening to The Essentials, The Reset. Don't move. Come right back.
Now that your age is not everything, now that your kids call you for advice, now that you can achieve anything you set your mind to, why stop? Nourish your strength and energy with Ensure. Ensure provides protein, antioxidants, key vitamins and minerals to support your immune system. Now that it's your moment to enjoy your vitality, why stop? Your life, your health, your Ensure.
The new Guardian Radio app is here. Listen live to all our Guardian Radio shows and live video stream select programs in our studio. Get information about Guardian Radio shows and our hosts. Send messages, including text, email, and even call. All from our amazing new Guardian Radio app. Download it free today in your App Store for your Apple device or Play Store for your Android device. The all-new and improved Guardian Radio app.
For the best jerk in the Bahamas, you must have Balu's. Pork, fish, and chicken served with our delicious country-style sauce and authentic festivals. Balu's, Nassau East South. Call or WhatsApp 376-8951. Balu's, the jerk with the soul of reggae and the spirit of Junkanoo. Balu's jerk, traditional, slow-cooked to perfection. 376-8951.
This is Guardian Radio, 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
And welcome back. I thought that that was a wonderful conversation. I thought that it gave us some good perspective. It also set, importantly, in context the news item that we saw coming out of the Jamaica Gleaner, where she spoke about us making it into the embrace of the IMF. And if nothing else, that was one of the things which we wanted to get out. As I was saying before she indicated to me that she had to run, if for nothing else, I am glad that she cleared up this whole idea of a monetary policy and the Bahamas policy. I have too often heard persons who ought to know better make the argument that we have no monetary policy, and as a result, that excuses us from not doing certain things that we ought to do. I have rebutted it in the past, but I'm certainly glad that Ms. Dukaran was able to do that this evening. Why is this important? It says that we have, at least in the minds of some individuals, we have more power, we have more facility, we have more assets than we actually do use at time. If you have a national currency, you must, by default, have your own monetary policy. It doesn't matter how closely allied to another country, in this instance, the United States. And so as she closed out in terms of solution, we must look at national debt. We're either going to seek principal reduction, maybe some forgiveness, or extending the debt so that it becomes easier to pay for. That is important because one of the things that we must do is to seek to free up capacity to be paying out 18%, well, that was the number, to be paying out 18% of total expenditure to debt financing. That which is likely to increase as a result of Moody's is way too significant at this point in time. We have to find ways where we can pump more money into infrastructure and to be able to season the economy for future growth. Fiscal responsibility, we have started on that track. That was a significant thrust under the FNM administration that has to be continued. It has to be enhanced. It has to be made better. And adherence. Adherence is going to be fundamentally, fundamentally important. She also made the point that we must, as a country, build a buffer. This is important. You have to save for a rainy day. There is absolutely no way you can spend and spend and spend and not be in trouble when trouble comes around. So we have to get to the point where we are seeing buffers. And buffers are usually created when the country is able to perform and deliver surpluses. But we may not be there yet. The starting point is, and this is encapsulated in the PLP's manifesto, the PLP's blueprint for change, is the development of a sovereign wealth fund. However that is going to be structured, we don't know. We don't need to know. Me and you don't need to know. The experts will do that. But we have to get to that place where we start saving for tomorrow. We have to get to that place where we have monies put aside to deal with some of these external shocks, to deal with the known vulnerabilities. And one of the important points that was made tonight was, in response to one of our listeners via Facebook, that the problem of the Bahamas started with Dorian. It is not accurate. And to hold on to that, and you are my friend, I know you very well. We interact a lot on Facebook. But if we are going to hold on to that position, then it's very likely that we are not going to solve the problems of the Bahamas. For many decades before Dorian and the COVID crisis, the Bahamas have been struggling with a multiplicity of problems. In the era of energy, BPL, in the era of state-owned enterprises, in the era of Bahamas Air, in the era of infrastructure and not having infrastructure at the level. We have seen over the last 10 years or so, where on a consistent basis, there have been reduction in capital expenditure, largely as a means of managing the wideness or to restrict the growth of the deficit. Pretty much that's what it is. So we know that we have some significant problems. We know that we have some significant challenges. And we certainly want to get to the place where we first admit and own up to those situations so that going forward we can fix it. One texter said, thanks, Mr. Essentials, the reset. So we want to thank you for listening. There was another individual who made a couple of points that without large-scale manufacturing in the Bahamas, what can we rely on for new money influx other than export of fisheries, resort, corporate investment, natural resources, tourism, or treasury salvage? I understand there's $1 billion or so treasury to be recovered. Maybe we can get a portion of that. Thank you, sir, for the content. Very pertinent information. I think it's good to get the information out there as many are unaware. But do you also believe there's an element where the bad news could lead to us talking or thinking ourselves into a downtrend by affecting consumer behavior, investment potential, personal business upgrades, etc.? There's always the possibility that when you have these discussions, persons may take away the negative side of it, get a little bit more risk averse, and not do the things which are necessary to grow us out. But at the end of the day, it's about understanding what is on the ground. It's about accepting the information for what it is, and then making a deliberate and intentional move to find the opportunities embedded in it. And so we are now faced with a downgrade. We are now faced with a challenging economic situation. And the upside of that is to say, we are going to solve this by fixing all of the issues which brought us to this point. So build a buffer, sovereign wealth fund. The other area was to look at, where she mentioned, foreign exchange control, and she see that as a deterrent to investment. It may very well be. We have significant controls around foreign exchange. Some have been rolled back. There have been a significant amount of liberalization in that regard over the last decade or so. But there still could be some areas which need to be looked at. Again, we can't just shift and create a disruptive environment because of the underlying peg and the way the economy is structured. But to the extent that that flexibility can lead to positive inflow or positive growth within the economy, then certainly we would want to do that. And then finally, in response to the idea promulgated by Oxford Economics that the way the Bahamas is going to grow and to achieve sustainable accelerated growth is for the policymakers to embark on a more ambitious at the time, and broad-based reform agenda to improve the domestic business environment. So if we reverse engineer that to today, basically what needs to be done is we have to become very, very aggressive, sensibly so and strategically so, but we have to want to garner more. We can't be tweaking and tiptoeing around the big issues. We have to become very pointed, very clinical, and attack the issues where they are. As I said in my recent article, we have to face the brutal facts which confront us. Not losing hope, not believing that we cannot do it and we cannot achieve it, but certainly being confident that we can get it done. But the only way we can get it done is to face up to them and to start to solve them. We are going to leave the conversation there as we are clean out of time. But as usual, we always say to you, never, ever, ever allow your greatness to become a victim of your unwillingness to change. We have had a very good conversation tonight, a very good discussion, and we look forward to future conversation. So walk good, be good, don't get into any trouble, abide by the protocols. One love, God bless, Jagat.